Footnotes, a legal podcast run by students for students, breaking down the complexities of the legal world one episode at a time. I'm David. I'm going to be your host for this episode. I've got my main man sitting right across from me, Justin Lai. He's going to be the co-host of this episode.
Cheers, David. I have an opening proposition for you.
Sure.
We've all read that one case which has like a patently absurd set of facts. We've all read that one judgment where the presiding magistrate goes into some strange anecdote or explanation, and we may have even heard of the reputation of a judge's wit or their literary style in writings.
Sure.
So, I just want to get your thoughts on the presumption then of the fact that the law might be a little bit boring.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, it's probably a deserved presumption. I can't say in my 2.5 years of doing law, I've never had any moment of liberty or joy other than just tearing my hair out and that feeling good because it's some sort of catharsis from all the exams I've been doing. No, you're right. I think law in general isn't something, especially compared to other subjects and other even more academic subjects in uni, law isn't something that you consider to be really entertaining or you can find humour from.
You're talking about history, decorum, you're talking about like millions of pages of writings. You're talking about lectures that go on and on forever. The truth is that the law is as lively and as strange and as funny as life and as reality.
Sure.
So this episode, we're going to cover some of the best and most bizarre cases of legal humour, judges, fact sets alike. We're also going to look at the case of whether humour should exist in the courtroom at all.
Okay.
And the surprising amount of theory which ends up backing it up. So we hope you have a laugh, as we had. Get right into it. So what we're going to do is we're going to divide our material into three distinct sections
okay.
for this episode. We're going to start with the first instance, which is when the facts themselves are funny. So that's very obvious when facts are just quite humorous, when things happen which are just a bit strange, and you know the law has to kind of preside over that and make a decision on an unexpected scenario.
Okay.
The second is when the judgment is funny. So maybe the facts themselves are not implicitly humorous, but the judge has taken some immense liberty to indulge in their comedic sensibility or to just engage in this really long anecdote, which might be just really bizarre or peculiar to us and thus elicits a sense of humor from us.
Okay.
And then the last one is when the submissions are funny. And this is very courtroom-based. It's a lot of barbs between counsel and the magistrate or even the litigants themselves. Let's start off with the first instance we talked about, which is when the facts themselves are funny. So this is an Australian case. This is the Queen and Clark from 1927 that was heard in the High Court. This is a case of contract law, but it's also, weirdly enough, a case of criminal law as well.
Okay.
The facts are as follows. There's a man named Evan Clark, and he tries to claim a reward for £1,000 of giving information which had led to the conviction of a murderer who had killed two policemen. So I'm going to start by sort of just establishing something real quick.
Yeah, sure.
How much money is £1,000, do you think?
I don't know, like, depending on how long ago, probably like a decent amount of money. I don't know. It's a lot for me. I'd take £1,000.
You're absolutely right. £1,000 is a lot for a student, you know, for you and I.
Yeah, yeah, hell yeah.
But let's take into a sort of account the fact that this occurred in 1927.
Okay.
So I Googled the exchange rate. The exchange rate means that £1,000 in 1927 is actually £64,411.72.
Jesus Christ.
And then the second part of that, the second layer, is that then you have to factor in the exchange rate between pounds and Australian dollars.
Ah, sure.
Which means that the total sum becomes $115,515. Oh, and 33 Australian dollars, which makes the whole like, oh, you know,
that's
I want to claim
mad.
A reward for a contract.
Yeah.
It justifies a lot of the action that we'll see.
Yeah, that's mad. I'd do anything for $100,000 right now.
Okay, we'll not get into that very sort of landmine territory of what we'll do for $100,000, but let's get into what actually happens, right? So
okay.
we have this idea of the plaintiff Clark, and he wants to claim a reward for a contract.
Yeah, sure.
So the twist is that Clark has given the information whilst being investigated for the same murder.
Okay.
So he'd originally been an accessory. He'd been investigated by the police for participating in the murder. He'd been someone who had covered for the murderer, right?
Yeah, sure.
He then changed his mind because you would when you're under investigation for murder. So he gave them the information on the basis that, well, you don't want to either perjure yourself or you don't want to get investigated.
Sure.
That means
that
we have this guy who participated in a murder, then decided to change his mind, right?
Yeah.
He then went through 3 different law courts in varying jurisdictions.
Yeah.
He goes to the Supreme Court of Western Australia.
Yeah.
He then goes to the Full Court of Western Australia.
Yeah.
Then he goes to the High Court, right? And he says, well, the information that I gave was in seeking that contract, which means I would like my $115,000, please.
I mean, this guy really backed himself, huh? He was really like, damn, I really got away with murder. How do I get like $100,000 in today's money off it?
I think that's like astounding entrepreneurship.
Yeah, I know. No, seriously. This guy's got a good brain on him. I would do the same, to be honest.
I think
if I was in this position.
You do really, I mean, other than like costs, you have nothing to lose.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, the legal costs when you went to the High Court was probably like more than $100,000. I don't know. Maybe he argued for himself in front of the court.
Yeah.
He seems like the type of bloke who would do that.
So the High Court comes to reject this, very plausibly speaking. They say, oh, you can't accept the reward for a contract if you don't enter it with the intention of making the contract in the first place. Fair that enough. Is to say that when you form a contract, it has to be your explicit intention to create that sort of legal relationship. And if you give, like, if you do an act and you don't like have that exquisite, like explicit intention. So like, for example, if you build a house and you're like, I just want to build this house, but then turns out someone had contracted on that land.
Yeah.
And you said, oh, can I have the money please? Cause I built the house and I bought all of these bricks to build the house with.
Sure, sure.
You can't get that money, right?
Okay. Yeah.
And that's like a really important principle of contract law. And that's something that is like drilled into your heads in contracts.
Mm.
It just happens to be attached to just, what a guy. it just happens to be attached to one of the great minds of the 20th century. A man who
absolute was, damn genius.
I think he was at his lowest point. And then now he is immortalized in contract textbook.
Seriously. All he was trying to do was get away with murder and secure the bag. But now he's a foundational piece of contract law in Australia.
Where would Australia be without him? How many contracts do you think would exist today if it were not for this man?
I know, yeah.
You talk about immortality.
Yeah.
Right? Is your name said at most universities in Australia?
No, it is not.
Exactly.
No.
We'll remember the name of
Talk about a legacy.
Forever.
I know.
Exactly. What is a legacy? Well, it's being made fun of on a podcast by a couple of students who have no idea what your life is like.
Hey, it is a massive honor to be made fun on this podcast by us too, okay? That's
absolutely
my 2 cents. Well, I do have another little case for you. This one's, I mean, it also involves immortality. It involves an immortal. So, this case is called United States ex rel Mayo against Satan and his staff. So,
okay,
you know,
okay.
It's going to be good.
Hold up.
Yeah.
Satan.
Yeah, they sued Satan.
Is this a guy or is this something, like, is it a manifestation of Satan?
No. It's like the Satan.
Oh, so it's like suing a deity.
Yeah. They just straight up sued Satan.
Oh, normal day at the office, right?
Yeah, no, exactly. So this isn't really even that interesting. We should move on, right?
I don't know why you even brought it up.
Well, okay. Since I brought it up, we might as well continue. But basically, this guy, Jerome Mayo, he filed a suit before the district court for the Western District of Pennsylvania, which is, of course, a court in the United States. And he argued that Satan has on numerous occasions caused the plaintiff misery and unwanted threats against the will of the plaintiff, and that Satan has placed deliberate obstacles in his path and has caused the plaintiff's downfall, therefore depriving him of his constitutional right.
Oh, yeah, because Satan cares.
Yeah.
Satan was like, well, the Constitution... It's like that in the Bible.
I don't know.
Like,
you
kryptonite.
But well, okay. So this guy sued Satan.
What is what does the magistrate have? What, like, I imagine you're a magistrate and you're sitting just in your courtroom.
Yeah.
And you get informed tomorrow or maybe at some point in the future,
mm-hmm.
you're going to be hearing a case about the Prince of Darkness.
Mm-hmm.
What does the judge then say on this matter?
You know what? I feel like I'd be pretty excited if I've just been adjudicated in cases like, oh, like my husband cheated on me. Can we have the divorce settlement up from like 40K to like 50 grand? I'd be like, hell yeah, I'm adjudicated cases. Stated. I'm going to tell all of my judge colleagues are going to be so jealous of me.
So who's the presiding magistrate over this case?
So this guy called Judge Weber, and he noted some, and maybe understatement of the legal century, he noted some general issues. One of the big issues was a jurisdictional issue. So they didn't know if the court actually had power over the plaintiff's set. That problem really applied to...
You mean defendant?
Yes, sorry, which party? His point was like, well, look, it's an American court. We don't really know if, like, Satan is American, right? And what did he say here? He said a couple of things. He said, the complaint contains no allegation of residence in this district, which I don't know if that's true. I mean, I'm sure you can just dig down and
can, like, you say that Satan lives everywhere?
Yeah, sure, just like underneath the ground, right? And I don't
or
know,
like in your head, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
And then
like,
he lives, he's sort of an ethereal presence,
yeah,
you could argue.
Well, or like, I mean, Pittsburgh is supposed to have like a ton of coal mines, right? Like pretty
or
deep
you could,
underground.
Or you could like take the more kind of sardonic route. You'd be like, this place is hell.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah. I don't know. I've never been to Pennsylvania. Yeah. I'm sure it's a lovely place, but...
My recent divorcee of a wife is Satan.
Well, what else did it... the gist of the judgment was like, Satan probably isn't an American, which, when you think about it, is an astounding level of sophisticated legal analysis, which no other judge except the brilliant mind of Judge Weber could have achieved in this case.
Yeah, I would say that we're lucky that he was called upon at this point in time.
I know.
I think there's an interesting point that Justice Weber also raises, which is that then Satan, because he's not an American, is like a foreign national.
Oh, okay.
Right? And thus he would have sovereign immunity from the suit. Those who remember public international law
True.
That sovereigns...
Hey, you think Satan's racked up parking fines at the UN?
Yeah, yeah. So Satan's responsible for a lot of misery all over the world. But, right?
Yeah.
Because he has absolute personal immunity for all of the acts that he undergoes when he's the prince of hell.
Yeah.
He's fine.
Okay.
He would have immunity.
Mm.
So
fair enough.
That's
the
I
rules
think,
are the rule.
A good piece of legal analysis for Satan. So he gets off on this.
Right.
So because this is a class action lawsuit against Satan, which is an interesting point itself.
Yeah.
Justice Weber has to map this judgment, or at least this case of this facts, on the requirements under US federal law for a class action lawsuit.
Sure.
He starts off by looking at the ones that do actually succeed, which is remarkable because of the fact that this actually ticks off a bunch of criteria in the first place.
Mm.
He says that, firstly, it has to be so that the class of like people represented as like a joinder, right? The joinder of all members is so impractical that the class represents all of those people.
Okay.
So the idea there is that like you have to consider everyone who, you know, this particular plaintiff is representing.
Sure.
And this is a lot of people because it's everyone who's been hurt by Satan, which means that it's everyone who believes Satan exists.
Sure.
Because I don't think usually, unless you're sort
of
an exception.
You got the devil worshiper.
Yeah,
you
got, if you're like a Satanist or something like that, you would believe obviously one thing about Satan. But those who maybe subscribe to more conventional Abrahamic religions would probably fall under the joinder of all of the people who would be hurt by Satan.
Sure.
So that's fine. That's something that's a big tick for our lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
The second is that the questions of law and fact are common to this class. Generally speaking, that's quite true.
Mm.
Satan causes misery to people who believe that, you know, God is good and things like that, because if God is good, then Satan is probably bad because God put Satan there in the first place.
Yeah, okay.
I don't speak on behalf of theology. We're not the theology podcast. We're the law podcast. The third thing here is that the claims of the representative party are typical to the claims of the class, which is something that we've already established is true.
Okay.
So the fourth point, which Justice Weber then says that the case falls down on, which is to say that it can't be a class action lawsuit properly, is that he's unable to determine whether the representative party will fairly protect the interests of the class, which is sort of this legal way of saying that the sort of he doesn't know whether a judgment in any capacity is going to, or even like a successful judgment on behalf of the plaintiff is going to protect everyone from Satan.
Sure.
Like you can't, like it's so hard to rule against Satan, the fact, which is the sort of then leads to several other issues of practicality. Like,
yeah, yeah.
who's going to tell him.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Who wants to be the guy that serves Satan?
What is, like, what if Satan doesn't follow the rule?
Yeah, true. Oh, God, Satan, not obeying the law.
Hey, buddy. The judge said so.
Stop it.
Right, you can't do this because it's against the law. And then
stop
Satan,
wreaking havoc on the world of men, Jesus.
Yeah, and then you're yelling into the floor.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. You get a call from Satan, like, sorry, the reception is terrible down here. The last point I think Justice Weber raises is, in my opinion, the best bit of this case.
Okay.
He points to the issue in service, which is an area of civil and criminal procedure that those who have studied that unit will be familiar with.
Yeah.
The plaintiff Mayo forgot to include the form of instructions for the U.S. Marshal for directions as to service of process.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say that he doesn't know where Satan lives, and because of that, he can't give him the form to come to court.
Yeah, fair.
I think it's very practical to say that's true.
Mm.
Where does he have a yellow pages?
I don't know. You can. I mean, is there a Facebook page for the guy?
Yeah, like Satan's contact details. Yeah, it's like his PA.
Instagram.
I think it's like,
I don't know.
Is this PA like Beelzebub or something? Or is that just another name for him? One
I
of his various devils.
Mephisto.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm a bit behind on my demonology. So.
Yeah. So like you would go on LinkedIn and you'd be like, well, can I contact the offices of Satan? Hell Incorporated.
I don't know. He seems like a guy who, you know, pick up a call if there are any queries.
If there's anything that is, you could argue that like, hell is just lots of red tape and administration.
True. Maybe it is.
So it would just be like, imagine just being sat in an office and you have to wait to get called up
to
see
someone. Secretary get back to you after arranging my schedule.
This is very Kafkaesque where it's like someone comes.
Maybe it is.
Yeah, someone gives you like a form to sign up and then the form goes on forever. And it's like, you have to give it back to me when you're finished. And then, you know, it takes a certain amount of infinity to fill out the form and then you have to give it in and you just wait for another time. And
true.
Oh, you have to fill out this other form. Essentially, it's just impossible to serve Satan.
Yeah.
Because you don't know how to get to him.
Yeah, sure.
Which means that the case very sadly has to come to an end.
Mm.
Because one, Satan, even if he, for example, is guilty of this crime, has immunity.
Yeah, sure.
Secondly, the suit itself doesn't meet the legal requirements to exist.
Mm.
And then thirdly, even if all of that were true, you can't find Satan. So you can't bring him to court. And because of that, you're unlikely to be able to get any level of representation on that matter.
Yeah.
And that brings us to the end of our first bit. We're going to now turn to the second part of this episode, which is when the judgments themselves are funny. And we're going to look very specifically a bunch of judges who go into rather absurd, like stand-up comedy level territory.
Well, I wouldn't go as far to call them stand-up comedy. They're attempts at comedy. They're okay. They're
literary humor.
I don't want to give them too much credit.
It's either... I think the best bits are when they're very inadvertent.
True.
They have to explain a point of law.
Yeah.
It's just very funny the way they do it.
Yeah. It's like, okay, sometimes they're funny, but when judges try to be funny, it's like the opposite of when 12-year-olds try to be funny, you know? 12-year-olds try to be funny. It's like so not sophisticated that it's just like, immature humor. But when judges to be funny, it's like they're still dropping like 15 letter words and like absurdly difficult syntax. And they're like, they're probably having a laugh with their colleagues who are also like judges, but us, we're like,
you can totally tell they write it for themselves.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they're like, oh, my friend will really enjoy this. And then people, because like outside of the law, no one's going to read your judgments.
Yeah, exactly.
So
yeah,
it's very placed and specific. There's no need to appeal. So they just go into these insanely long, like sort of trajectories of reasoning that end up being humorous, sort of in their own right, in a way. They're like independently quite funny as opposed to necessarily having to be about anything.
Yeah.
So do you have anything for us, David?
Well, I've got a case here, actually. It's called PGAA Tour Incorporated versus Martin. So again,
PGA.
Yeah, PGA, like
the golf place.
The golf place, yeah.
So not like the place, but like the sort of the institution.
The institution, the big institution. So someone sued the PGA. This is an American case, by the way. I think a lot of funny cases are American cases because
I agree.
It's America. And so basically this guy called Martin, I mean, rightfully so, he had a disability and he sort of was asking PGA if instead of walking between shot to shot, he could take a golf court and ride it around, which to me, you know, I'm not a golf connoisseur, but it doesn't really matter, right? But I guess the PGA were just a bit up themselves and they're like, no, like it's like not the sport anymore. Anyway, the American disabilities legislation says that the activity or the event should make as much accommodation, should accommodate the person with a disability as much as possible, to the extent that it doesn't like substantially or fundamentally alter the nature of the activity. So this case was really about like, what is the fundamental slash nature of the activity, which is golf. And this went, believe it or not, went all the way up to the Supreme Court for the states, where it was met by one Antonin Scalia. Most of the listeners, you should know who Scalia is. Sadly, passed away a couple of years ago, but when he was, I guess, in his prime, whether or not you agree with the legal philosophy, absurdly funny writer. So this is what he wrote on the matter. It has been rendered the solemn duty of the Supreme Court of the United States, laid upon it by Congress in pursuant of the federal government's power to regulate commerce with between nations and amongst the several states, to decide what is golf. I am sure that the framers, of the Constitution, aware of the 1457 edict of King James II of Scotland prohibiting golf because it interfered with the practice of archery, fully expected that sooner or later the path of golf and governed law and the links would once again cross, and the judges of this august court would someday have to wrestle with that age-old jurisprudential question for which the years of studying the law will have prepared them so well. Is someone riding around a golf course from shot to shot really a golfer?
You can tell that he's so done.
He's so fed up.
He's like, I'm on the Supreme Court of the United States of America.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean,
this is the court that heard like Roe and Wade.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like in the 70s, they're like, all right, let's protect the woman's right to choose. In 2007, that's not to say this is a joke. That's not to say they didn't have important cases after. But Scalia at the time must have been like, damn, now we're like debating what is golf.
Yeah, like Brown and Board of Education, yeah, all these landmark cases that like enshrine rights.
Yeah.
And then he has to then judge.
I mean, a golfer's right to ride around in a golf car is pretty important, Justin. Shouldn't put that down.
I don't need to put it down.
It's very important.
I agree that golf and golfers are a class of individuals mentioned in the Constitution.
I agree. Yeah.
These are the people to really, whom if life, really, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are all engaged on.
If you really read between the lines.
Exactly. Yeah. You have to squint really hard really between really the lines. Hard. That is to say that to all of these people who represent citizens of America, no doubt one of them, or at least several of them, played golf at the time of the writing of the Constitution. Does our friend Martin win this case?
Our friend Martin, just as the framers of the United States Constitution did intend, did win this case.
I'm so happy.
Yeah, I know. I'm happy for the man. The Supreme Court said in a 7-2 decision that it wouldn't fundamentally alter the nature of the sport, which is like, I mean,
who dissented?
I mean, Scalia and the other guy who is not as funny, I guess. So, I mean, like, if you dissent on a case like this where you're like, nah, bro, like, if you got disabilities, you just gotta, like, walk it.
Like, imagine being, traditionalist and a golf radicalist.
I'm a radical progressive golfer, people.
Where it's like, either golf is all of the rules of golf.
Yeah.
Or golf is, you walk from place to place
with
a ball and a thing that hits it. Mm. So then tennis becomes golf.
True.
So pool is golf.
So pool is golf. Yeah. You're hitting balls into holes. Yeah.
Exactly.
It is what it is. Yeah. But I think the main thing is just, it's pretty funny how ticked off Scalia was.
Absolutely. So I've got another case. This is an Australian case for you.
Okay.
It sounds quite boring. It actually is quite black letter and very kind of rigid in terms of the way it applies.
Okay.
But it contains one of the most absurd non sequiturs I have ever read in my entire life.
Sure.
This is the case of Nature's Care Manufacturers Party Limited and Australian Made Campaign Limited. So I'll give you the facts, which are quite sort of stock standard. Nature's Care manufactures sort of these medicines which are sold under the brand Healthy Care Australia.
Mm.
You may be familiar with them. They do like gummies and things like that. The particular thing that was being scrutinized under this case was fish oil and vitamin D capsules that were sold by Nature's Care.
Right.
The second thing to know is that this case primarily concerns the Australia Made and Owned logo and the use of that logo. So that's something which, if listeners are familiar with, is the sort of kangaroo within a triangle with green and gold. That just indicates that.
I think I've seen it.
Yeah, it's in a lot of products in like supermarkets and stuff. It just verifies that this is a product which has been made in Australia or has been made with Australian like ingredients and things like that.
Sure.
So since 2012, Nature's Care held like a license to use that logo because you need it as a registered, like a registered trademark by the Australian Made Campaign Limited, which is the AMC, that's responsible for the use of that logo, and it issues like 12-month licenses. In 2018, AMC proposed that the license should not be reviewed on the basis that it was inaccurate to represent those fish capsules as being made in Australia.
Okay.
So very stock standard consumer stuff.
Sure.
They said that the manufacturing process was not, in fact, Australian, was quite cosmopolitan because of the constituent ingredients that were being sourced that made like the fish capsules, right? They said that it was basically too international. So the central point of this case is that whether Nature's Care could accurately represent to consumers that its capsules were made in Australia.
Mm.
So that's just the broad area of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
The kind of case turns on this idea of, well, how do you establish that the capsules are made in Australia, right?
Mm-hmm.
You establish, according to the facts of this case, and indeed the arguments of this case, that one, that the capsules were last substantially changed in Australia.
Okay.
And that secondly, the goods were fundamentally different in identity, nature, or essential character from the original imported ingredients.
Sure.
Right? Nature's Care argues that the processes which have been conducted in Australia changed the character of the original ingredients so that the final product could be differentiated from the important ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
The original ingredients include fish oil from Chile, keep this in our head for later, vitamin D3 from China, and glycerol from Indonesia.
Well,
let us now turn to Justice Perham's thoughts on the matter. He writes as follows, and I quote, "I find that the fish oil imported from Chile smells unpleasant. I was provided with a sample of this fish oil as Exhibit MX3 and have smelt it. It smells like a cross between stale fish and vinyl. My associate thinks that it smells like semi-fermented grass cuttings, revealing his more sophisticated nose. I have not tasted it, but I am prepared to infer that it would be very unpleasant to consume in even small doses. I also find that the fish oil can be extracted from the capsules. Indeed, the labeling suggests that in the case of children, it may be appropriate to pierce the capsule and squeeze its contents into milk, juice, or cereal. It is inevitable that when this is done, that the malodor of the fish oil will reemerge. It is to be noted, therefore, that whilst encapsulation of the fish oil removes the odor problem for most users, the applicant can contemplate some uses of its fish oil with vitamin D capsules where the odor problem will reemerge."
Oh my God.
And finally, almost to the best part,
there
is a related issue, isn't there, Justice Perham? Professor Barrow properly drew my attention to the phenomenon of burp back. Burp back occurs when a soft gel capsule containing something malodorous, such as fish oil, is consumed. Once the capsule descends into the digestive depths of the stomach, the soft gel dissolves, releasing its noxious payload, the odor which, thus liberated, rises
noxious
up to the gullet.
Noxious
payload. Rises up to the gullet of the mouth where, unsought and unwelcome, it presents itself as a salutary warning against the perils of belching. Professor Barrow succinctly described it as unpleasant fishy burping.
Oh, okay.
Just because the soft gel fails in the inhospitable regions of the upper reaches of the alimentary canal does not mean that for many people the capsule is not effective to protect them from the smell of fish oil.
Mm.
It does actually mean, however, that it cannot be entirely correct to say that the encapsulation has changed the nature of the fish oil so that its odor is no longer present.
Mm.
It can be present when the fish oil is extracted from the capsules, and it may emerge should a consumer burp.
Do you think this is what his years of study in the law prepared him for?
I think it
extensive
is.
Extensive legal
this
analysis
is,
on...
It's stunning legal analysis because he actually does prove a really good point.
Sure, yeah.
He proves that the fish oil doesn't change when you consume it, and that Nature's Care has acknowledged the fact that the fish oil can be removed and thus is separate from the capsule.
Yeah,
right?
Sure.
So the court then eventually holds
that
the ingredients are not sufficient to be labeled as Australian made.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of that, the license is revoked and Australian Made Campaign Limited is successful.
Sure.
In that case.
Okay.
So yeah.
My mum used to make me swallow those fish oil.
Mine as well.
Capsules, so.
I did a lot of that. It was really disgusting.
Omega something. Yeah, it was. Because, I mean, well, you didn't taste the fish oil, but I just...
I remember
it was
when
like
I was
plastic
young,
capsule.
I drink the fish oil straight.
Really?
Yeah.
My condolences.
My condolences for myself as well. So we would like have to get a big spoonful. You know, there's like old spoonfuls of like porcelain spoons.
Yeah,
you
just
do them and then you would go out and you would attempt to have a nice day.
Oh,
like I did have several nice days with that fish oil, but I also had several nice days without that fish oil. And
like how much do you have to brush to get out like that?
You had that after you brushed.
Yeah. Oh my God.
So it was like it stayed in your mouth until you drank water. Or you had a meal.
That's so
gross. I couldn't consent to that. I was like 8.
Yeah, yeah.
My parents were like, it's good for you. And then like they would just give you a spoonful and they'd say, here's a good boy. And then you drink it because you get coerced by the fact that you get called a good boy.
Oh, yeah, right? Exactly. So that was judgments and facts. But I am interested in a little bit. We've covered the judge. We've covered the, I guess, you know, the facts really come about as a result of the defendant and the plaintiff. Is there anything funny that comes out of, say, the lawyers?
Absolutely, David. I'm glad you asked that because some of the best stuff comes from the fact that judges and lawyers don't always get along.
Yeah, true.
Or at least they serve different functions. We know that obviously lawyers become judges, right? You can't just go and become a judge from the get-off.
Sure.
Right? Usually you either have to practice or you have to do something. Mm-hmm. But judges often at times are quite separate to that fact, and lawyers stand in the way of them maybe potentially doing things. And the relationship then is one of sort of banter,
mm-hmm.
one of maybe disdain, even an element of just being fed up with the whole process.
Yeah, they pretty much probably hate each other.
Absolutely.
At some points. Yeah.
And there's also relationships that judges have with each other.
Mm.
So they're friends, they get along, they have the same sense of humor.
Mm.
But sometimes they may often criticize each other and their own approaches.
So, do you think like Edelman J ever goes up to Kiefer and just like, hey, you want to hang out sometime?
I think they do. I think like, I know that at least from what people have told me,
yeah,
that judges often just hang out together.
Really?
Their families know each other. They're friends, genuinely.
That's fair.
In that sense.
If I had to pick friends on the, I think Bal, Keane, Kiefer are probably like pretty tight. They're like besties.
I'd want to know Justice Kiefer.
Yeah, same. She seems cool. I don't know. Edelman seems like a great guy, but he's like a little bit, he's like a lot younger than all the others, right?
Yeah.
There's a bit of like an age gap. He's like 20 years younger
mm-hmm.
than everyone else.
He's like the fresh
yeah, yeah,
kid.
Yeah, he like, I mean, I don't know. I read about it. Like he goes on runs and stuff. So he's always probably like, guys.
Like, I like how it's like, oh, he can run. Yeah, yeah, he's good. He's fine.
Well, it's an accomplishment.
And I like the way that we refer to Justice Edelman, a man who is significantly our senior, as the kid,
yeah,
as the young one.
Yeah, well,
which indicates obviously the status.
Well, I mean, he's not significantly us. I mean, like in terms of like status, yeah.
Well,
but he's only three years
older than us.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's like, well, like 46,
yeah.
47, which is like, not like, my dad's older than that, you know?
Yeah, mine's is too. Yeah,
yeah, so there you go. Yeah. He's like uncle kind of seniority.
Yeah,
like younger
he's like
uncle.
He's the cool uncle who serves on the high court.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I'd vibe with that.
Yeah, I would.
I'd be a recipient of his banter.
he probably has good banter.
Of the classic wit that is we have come to expect from his honor.
Yeah, yeah, of course, yes.
As he was referred to at the time.
Mm.
So, I do have some funny instances of judges with their acerbic wit. Yeah. I think this is where judges shine, to be honest.
Okay.
Judges in their response, in their sort of like their interactions and their relationships with counsel, and even sometimes with litigants themselves, are often where judges come up with the zingers.
Sure.
They come up with like the firecrackers.
Mm.
So, I'll open with someone who is very famous. So Hayden Stark, who's a former High Court justice.
Of course.
He was apparently known, as some judges are, similar to how Scalia was, for his exceptional sense of humor.
Wow.
His killer sense of black humor in particular. And in the case of the Federal Commissioner of Taxation and Hoffnung and Company Limited in 1928, he wrote, because he was sort of a bit fed up with the counsel for the defense, he said, "This is an appeal from the Chief Justice, which was argued by this court over 9 days with some assistance from the learned and experienced counsel who appeared for the parties."
Yeah.
"The evidence was taken and the matter argued before the Chief Justice in 2 days. This case involves two questions of no transcendent importance, which are capable of brief statements and could have been exhaustively argued by the learned counsel in a few hours." Well, he's essentially really annoyed at the fact that the defense is taking too long for their submissions to the court. The best thing about this is that the counsel which Justice Stark was roasting for wasting the court time,
sure,
was Owen Dixon.
Okay.
The famous Owen
Dixon.
Oh,
the Owen Dixon.
The Owen Dixon.
Like Dixon J. Owen
yeah,
Dixon.
Yeah, Justice Dixon.
Oh, wow, okay.
Sir Owen Dixon.
Yeah.
Who would join the High Court bench 3 months later.
Oh, my God.
So another instance is a very famous New South Wales court judge.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Justice Roderick Meagher.
Oh, equity man, right?
Yeah, yeah, he was renowned for theory and practice of judicial humour.
Mm.
In this particular case, which is JBQS Party Limited and Cosman and Construction Party Limited,
sure,
heard in the New South Wales Court of Appeal in 2003, he made some remarks about the suburb of Bosley Park.
Right. Where is Bosley Park, actually?
That's actually something which he talks about.
Oh.
He refers to development of certain land can be said to be situated at Bosley Park. And he puts in brackets, wherever that is.
Me, every time someone mentions a suburb outside of the inner western CBD, hey, bro, I'm from New Zealand. Where is that? Oh, Chatswood. Oh, that's where it is. Oh, nice.
So the president of the court, Keith Mason, made some comments on those remarks, claiming that Justice Meagher's lack of knowledge of suburbs of a lower socioeconomic status than where Justice Meagher resides, which was Darling Point. It was just like, you're a classist. He writes as follows.
Yeah.
I've had the benefit of reading the draft, the reasons of Justice Meagher. I also have the benefit of having access to a street directory. Accordingly, I do not share His Honour's customary doubts about the location of well-known Sydney suburbs lying to the west of Darling Point, which sit cheek by jowl with His Honour's customary lack of doubts about most other matters. A useful resource for those who need to locate Bosley Park is http://www.travelmate.com.au.
That's actually a good chat.
By clicking on map marker, one can easily find ways of getting from, say, Darling Point to that suburb.
That's brilliant. Where is, I want to search this up now. Okay, let's pull up Bosley Park. Where is this place? Oh, it's like not that far out. It's like by like Bank Sound kind of area.
It's near, yeah, it's like it's near Wetherill Park.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Sort of close to Fairfield. It's in sort of, yeah, like yeah, it's in a significant
it's like really
area
close
of Western
to Fairfield. Yeah.
It's in a significant area of Western Sydney. So it's sort of like, yeah, Darling Point's sort of adjacent to Potts Point. So it's just off Double Bay.
Oh, okay. So it's only really an hour and 30's worth of a train, just as, you know. All respect to the Justice
All respect
Appeal.
To Justice Meagher, yeah.
He really should have just searched it up on Google Maps.
Yeah, but it's 2003. Like Google Maps doesn't exist at this point in time.
Oh,
that's
true.
Why he referred to travelmate.com. Why he has to refer to a street directory.
That's true.
You know,
still.
Like, you have to plan your route. The infrastructure clearly was not built up at this point in time. So, Justice Meagher actually ends up having the last laugh in this case.
Oh, really?
He does, because his response was, while preparing the head note for the judgment, to include held per President Mason with Justice Beasley agreeing. A useful resource for those who need to locate Bosley Park is http://www.travelmate.com.au. So it makes it to the official heading.
That's pretty funny.
That's great. I think that is good banter. I think it's great chat from Justice Meagher.
Yeah, and Mason.
And Justice and President Mason.
And sorry, President Mason.
Yeah, I think the back and forth was exceptional.
Good.
There.
Yeah,
I think.
And probably this is probably a case about like land development.
It is literally just about land development. Okay, it's great. Quite boring about
I'm
permits
glad they had
and stuff
a bit
like
of back
that.
And forth and banter.
We're going to turn now to something which is quite interesting, and I think raises a bunch of questions about what judges can be dismissed for, which is criticisms of judicial humour. So all of the things that we've talked about are things that have to do with judges being funny,
okay,
whether it's inadvertent or whether it's advertent. We're now going to talk about whether that runs into any issues with judicial conduct.
Well, think of, okay, so I've got some stuff here. Think of, say, if I told you the name of this organisation was the Council of the Chief Justices of Australia. Give me a thumbs up or thumbs down in terms of thumbs up, fun, thumbs down, not fun.
I'm going to put thumbs down, but I do recognise their importance to life.
Yeah.
And indeed the courts.
Okay, so you'd think thumbs down, right? They do lots of important stuff. But this is what they actually say, and this quite surprised me. They say that the trial of an action, whether civil or criminal, is a serious matter, but that does not mean occasional humour is out of place in a courtroom, provided that it does not embarrass a party, or, well, that actually takes away a lot of the humour we've been looking at, but provided it does not embarrass a party, fault witness. Indeed, it sometimes relieves tension and thereby assists the trial process. So they are a fan in limited circumstances, but they acknowledge the fact that
it's okay to be funny.
Yeah.
Because we're human, right?
Look, they probably don't like reading 100 pages on like land development either.
They're the Council of Chief Justices of Australia. Yeah. They love that stuff. That's their livelihood, David.
Can I just say though, when I imagine the Council of the Chief Justices of Australia, I sort of imagine them sitting like around like a circle of like stones wearing like Gandalf's
Have
robes.
Have you watched Hot Fuzz?
No, I haven't.
So in Hot Fuzz, there's a scene where there's like a bunch of people, like I'm not going to spoil the movie, but for those who've watched the movie Hot Fuzz, you'll know what I'm talking about, and you'll know what David's sort of, I guess, like description was when there's a bunch of people in robes sitting at a table made of stone, and they're all convened on the matter to discuss very sort of menial affairs. Very funny,
right? Okay,
I won't spoil the movie for anyone,
because
that may be without, maybe outside of the bounds of this podcast.
But yeah, I'll we don't spoil stuff.
We don't spoil stuff at all.
Only cases, but that's okay.
Absolutely. But I mean, they were already spoiled to begin with. I think the thing with judicial humor that runs into the most concern is when it's at the expense of the litigant.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is broadly acknowledged in the literature.
Yeah.
Right? So it can actually be incredibly humiliating for people to be made fun of by a judge.
Sure.
Because like, think about if you're made fun of by someone, right? Think about how if you consider the law to be an area where you go to for security, for safety, if a judge is like, you're an idiot and just like laughs in your face, how does like, that might make you feel in some way.
They
just make you feel like really like uncomfortable, right? Because you're just like, oh, I like totally thought I had a right to something.
You're probably already like quivering in your boots in the courtroom anyway. It's a pretty terrifying place.
Like spending their time in court can be like incredibly stressful. Mm. It can be like the most traumatic thing they've ever done in their entire lives.
Yeah, sure.
It can be really, really difficult, right?
Yeah.
Because of the fact that there are extenuating things. For example, costs that may affect their mind. Maybe they're not fluent English speakers, which might affect their ability to negotiate, or that might affect their ability to communicate what happened to them to a judge, to a magistrate. The thing that I want to talk about is the only incident of where humor was investigated in an official capacity as an area of judicial misconduct.
Okay.
Right? So this is the case of Magistrate Brian Maloney of the New South Wales Local Court in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
He presided over an AVO case where there was a self-representing litigant who required a translator. Justice Maloney attempts to convince the litigant to withdraw their application and asks the translator to explain the benefits by using Arabic words like and but, so he understands, clearly trying to make light of the fact that the litigant is not a fluent speaker of English.
Yeah.
So the applicant demands a hearing, to which Justice Maloney responds, "Phew, cheerio, I'll put that down for 4 hours. That'll go on forever and ever." Jeez. Clearly making light. This isn't even funny.
He's just being really mean, really awful
to this poor person who like is go like an AVO is no like,
yeah,
funny.
Exactly. Yeah, I was gonna say this is serious stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So the applicant complained on the basis that he had felt humiliated by Maloney's conduct, and the courtroom apparently, and I don't get this, had laughed at all the things he had said. The conclusion is really interesting to this idea. So Justice Maloney is investigated, but was ultimately, you know, like he wasn't like remanded or anything. He just remained on the bench, but he was reduced to like a non sort of judging role.
Yeah.
It was due to an interesting technicality. His conduct had been found to have been as a result of a mental illness. So he was bipolar.
Oh.
And that meant that he would have to have been dismissed for incapacity, not misbehavior.
So him being a real, you know, is because he was bipolar?
Apparently. This is what at least the commission found.
Fair enough.
The parliament found that his disorder did not incapacitate him sufficiently. And that is the only instance where misconduct on the basis of improper humour was ever investigated in Australia. What do you think we can take away from this, David?
Okay, well, look, a couple of things. One, sometimes the law, I do stand corrected, sometimes the law is pretty damn funny, whether it's, I think, an interesting set of facts or the judge decides to be a little bit humorous. I still don't buy that judges are funny, but sometimes they can have a few good one-eyelers. Or just in general, sort of like good court proceedings. Those are pretty funny, but those are just people roasting each other, which is always funny. It's always funny to see people who are supposed to be like, you know, the most formal, the most stuck up people you sort of have in your mind. Just be a bit human and throw a couple of punches at each other.
It's really easy to get a misconception that judges are like judicial robots.
Exactly.
You know, like we read them, we're like, oh God. Like, I mean, to know that judges have a personality is to like go beyond just knowing that Justice Kirby is always dissenting.
Yeah.
You know, and to know that maybe like justices, you know, judges, all these people in the law, they're human.
Yeah, yeah,
and
right.
They're all people.
Yeah.
People are funny.
Sure.
Some people are funny in their very, very unique own ways.
Yeah.
So it's nice to know that. I think it's also very helpful to retain facts. I always remember the funny cases.
Mm. Yeah,
it always helps me when I study something to just figure out which case I remember because it made me laugh.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
I think that's a really good point.
Yeah. So, I think this episode has been full of laughs for us. I think we had a pretty good time recording this. I hope for you, the audience, it's also been full of laughs. And maybe, just maybe, you'd be more inclined and... Actually, I don't know if I recommend doing this. Don't search up law and, you know, spare time as a hobby. But you'd be inclined to, next time when you run across a funny case, more thoroughly read it because it could be a great source of entertainment. But we hope from footnotes that you had a good time listening to today's podcast and that you have thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm David, your host of this episode, signing off.
I'm Justin, your co-host, signing off.